Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'd like to welcome you all to the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Sciences Lecture Series. It's a great pleasure to have you all here today. And it's also a great pleasure to have one of the young scientists here at Scripps giving a presentation this evening. Jeffrey Gerhardt is a graduate student here at Scripps. He works with Dr. Jerry Kooijman. He's actually from Holland and has a wonderful background in engineering, of all things, coupled with marine biology. And he's traveled the world getting his education. He did his engineering degree in Holland, studied marine biology in Costa Rica, followed by a master's degree in marine biology in Puerto Rico, and now he's here at Scripps pursuing his PhD degree. Prior to coming here at Scripps, he worked as a marine biologist in Indonesia, and you're going to hear a lot about his work in Indonesia here this evening. So I hope you'll all join me in giving a warm welcome to Jeffrey Gerhardt, and he's going to tell us about sea turtles of Indonesia, New Guinea. Thank you very much for being here, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you, Cheryl. Wow, this is a big audience. There's like 100 people and 200 sardines in the back. It's a pleasure for me to see you all here so I can share a little bit of my passion and interest for sea turtles in Indonesia. So sea turtles, there's seven existing extant species of sea turtles. They've been around for a long time. They've been around for since the late Jurassic, for 145 million years. The leatherbacks that you see here on this picture have been around for over 100 million years. So they've survived the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, and now they're facing probably the greatest threat in their whole existence, which is the human threat. So why do I study sea turtles? Basically, I think that sea turtles are extremely interesting scientifically because they're very large animals, but despite their large size, they're very poorly understood, just like the great whales. And also keystone species. So you know that some sea turtles, for instance, play an important role in eating seagrass and keeping seagrass meadows very productive. That has a whole effect on that particular ecosystem. In the case of leatherbacks have a very great hunger for jellyfish, and you know that jellyfish right now are probably caused by climate change, are blooming in certain periods of year and interfering with fisheries. And so you get an idea that if you get rid of the leatherbacks, you have an increasing population of jellyfish, with the impacts it has on fisheries. Sea turtles are also very vulnerable to climate change, and this is due to the fact that sea turtles are depend on sandy beaches to lay their eggs, and obviously with sea level rise, these nesting habitats are disappearing. So all this combined with heavy fishing pressure, mostly fishery bycatch, because humans generally do not target leatherbacks; they're not very good for consumption. There's a few exceptions and a few traditional societies that hunt leatherbacks, but all this contributes to the fact that leatherbacks are critically endangered. So finally, because of this status and also because of the fact there is an emotional bond between humans and these big animals, such as the great cats in Africa, the cetaceans, and the sea turtles, these flagships become like figureheads for conservation. And this enables to have a wider reach and a wider impact. When one protects a flagship, one has an ecosystem impact, an ecosystem level impact. An example is that before I came here to Scripps in 2008, I was working as a biologist and conservationist in West Papua in an archipelago called Raja Ampat. And one of the things I did is I protected an island which was a very important nesting site for green sea turtles. And these turtles were being wiped out by poachers. So I set up, together with a local NGO, we set up a program to protect this island, to protect these turtles. So we set up a patrol post and patrolmen who were there every day of the week, the whole year. And because of their mere presence, they not only protected the sea turtles from a certain disappearance, but they also managed to get all the destructive fishers, the dynamite fishers, the cyanide fishers, the shark finners away. So now when I return there, I try to return every year, I like to go dive on the reefs, and every time I go there, I see bigger sharks and more numerous sharks. I see healthier corals, and I realize that by just targeting these sea turtles, we in fact protected the whole ecosystem. And that is one other reason why I think sea turtles are very interesting. So why West Papua? So I have, as Cheryl said, I have a background with Indonesia. I've been going to Indonesia since 1978 with my parents, spending 3 to 4 months there. So I have, I've been partially raised in Indonesia. And when I finished my master's in Puerto Rico, I went there and I lived there 6 years, based in Bali, and I would work in different islands of the archipelago, and I ended up in this region over here, Raja Ampat. So this this map here is a zoom out of this part here of New Guinea. New Guinea is this island. It's the second largest island in the world. And people very often mix up Papua or West Papua with Papua New Guinea. I haven't met anyone so far who hasn't mixed those two countries. So the thing is that New Guinea is divided in two at the half. And the eastern half is called Papua New Guinea, sometimes called PNG. And Papua New Guinea is an independent country. And the western half belongs to Indonesia. And it has changed names over the years. And now the most recent change is they've reverted to the original name, which is Papua, and it's divided into West Papua and Papua. So still, with my explanation, it's still complicated. So before getting into my research work, I would like to give you a little explanation about the sea turtle life cycle. So we're going to focus on the adult life stage. So adults basically forage in predetermined areas. Depending on the species, you have some species that forage in neritic coastal areas because they feed, dependent on the sea bottom, they feed on seagrass, for instance, the green sea turtles, hawksbill turtles are dependent on coral reefs, so they have their foraging grounds close to shore. Some turtles, like the leatherback, have really pelagic lifestyles, and they roam around general large-scale areas, but you can still pinpoint the origin of a leatherback. So what the adults do is they, when they're ready for reproduction, they travel to the very same nesting beaches where they were born. This is called natal homing. And they have this built-in GPS, and they just remember, okay, this is where I have to go to. So they travel to these nesting beaches. They mate. And the females every 2 weeks has a clutch of eggs that's ready to be laid on the beach. So at night, crawls up the beach, lays a clutch, in the case of leatherbacks, of about 100 eggs, and repeats this cycle 5 to 7 times in the case of leatherbacks. After this whole cycle, the females and the males independently return back to their foraging areas. So this is the adult life stage. Pacific leatherbacks can be subdivided into subpopulations. So the Eastern Pacific subpopulation, as you might know, nests on the western shores of Central America, from Mexico down to Costa Rica, and a little bit in Panama also. So as I told you, in the life cycle, after nesting, a nesting period of about 2 months, they migrate back to their foraging area, which is, in the case of East Pacific leatherbacks, is located off the very rich waters of South America. After approximately 2 and 2.5 years of growing and fattening up, because they don't feed during their nesting period, they return back to their nesting sites. So here off California, all the way up to Canada, and actually up to the Aleutian Islands, there are leatherbacks feeding in the waters. They don't nest, obviously, because they need tropical temperatures, but they feed off these waters. And scientists have asked themselves, okay, where do these leatherbacks come from? Obviously, they come from the beach where they were born, but is that beach over here in Central America? I mean, it would be logical because it's not too far away. But how do you do that? I mean, we have satellite tags that we can put on turtles on land. That's a very easy procedure. You just wait till the turtle comes up, put the tag on it, and it carries it in the ocean. The problem with these are turtles that are free roaming in the ocean. So I have colleagues at NOAA in Monterey, and they figured out a way of capturing these animals at sea. So they have an airplane that spots the turtles, a radios in to the boat where the position of the turtle is, and with a giant dip net, capture the leatherback. This is an individual that's 645 kilos, which is very big. It's not as I've seen pictures of turtles that are over a ton in weight. These are old pictures. I don't know if there's still turtles that size left. So these are really, really big. And here you see this. They attached a satellite tag to this female. And then they thought, okay, this female is obviously going to swim southward to Costa Rica. And instead of that, it went due west. And it crossed the entire Pacific and went to Indonesia. So I'm gonna show you in a map further in the presentation the exact migration route. So obviously this particular individual was a West Pacific leatherback, which is the other subpopulation. So West Pacific leatherbacks are in fact a metapopulation, which size is approximately 5,000 nesting females. We don't know about the males, but we can count the females. And the females are about 5,000, and they nest primarily around the island of New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. And in New Guinea, the two nesting sites that are most important are located on the bird's head. And you can see this is a little bit the shape of a prehistoric bird. That's why it's called the bird's head. And the two most important nesting beaches over here. So this is like the last stand of the West Pacific leatherback. So the turtles that nest over there are, in fact, they're genetically identical. However, they form two distinct demographic units. They're two different groups. And they're different because they have a very different spatial and temporal usage of these nesting sites. When we look at the beach of Jamuz Mameri, which is this one over here, which has 300 to 900 females nesting every year, has nesters that nest primarily during the trade season, which corresponds to our summer months. Whereas 30 kilometers away in Wormon, which is the other beach, so it's very close by, turtles nest there primarily during the monsoon season, which corresponds to our winter. And turtles from one beach generally don't nest on the other beach, and you're going to understand why this is. However, over the last 25 to 30 years that studies have been done, surveys have been done of the nesting beaches, primarily here in Jamuz Mameri, we found that the number of nests is steadily declining, whereas Wormon is remaining stable, if not increasing. So there are different hypotheses of why this is happening. One of the things that we're thinking is that climate is changing, the temperatures of the beaches are changing, and we find many nests that are basically cooked. Many eggs are basically cooked by very high temperatures. But there might be other explanations. There might be something happening in the ocean. Maybe there's changing current regimes that affect the little turtles. Once they enter the ocean, they might be carried away to areas that have less food. So these are all things that we're thinking about. Here I'm showing you a little flyover of the coast of the bird's head, and this is specifically the Jamuz Mameri, the summer nesting beach. And here you can see there's some big rivers flowing in. There's a very steep mountains covered with dense rainforests, pristine beaches. Because of these rivers discharging a fair amount of sediment in the ocean, the coral reefs are not as well developed as in Raja Ampat, more to the west. And one thing that I think is pretty cool about those beaches is that there's very few litter. And this is something you see everywhere in Indonesia. You can go to the wildest places and you still find plastics on the beaches. And this is probably due, by the way, because of the way the currents flow off this region. And you get some pictures of how it looks like. This is an aerial picture of Jamos Bamedi, and you see here how beautiful these places are. So another very interesting aspect is that the winds have a very strong influence on the topography of the beaches. During the southeast trade wind season, which corresponds to our summer, the winds blow very strongly from the southeast to the northwest, and therewith bring a lot of wave action. And these waves cause the beach in Wormhon, this beach, which is exposed to these winds, it causes these beaches to erode. And obviously, the turtles on a beach like this, they can't even go up, let alone nest. So this area, during the southeast trades winds season, is almost not used by turtles because the beaches are unsuitable for nesting. What happens in Jamos Bamedi during that same season? Because Jamos Bamedi is not exposed to all these waves that are brought about by these winds, Jamos Bamedi piles up sand and becomes very favorable to nesting. And this explains why there is this peak of nesting in one beach during one season and the other beach during the other season. So there's an interaction between physical factors and biological factors. Now we look at the opposing season. This is during our winter, and northwest monsoon winds start to blow very steadily, and this beach is more exposed, and this beach erodes away just as the other beach. So there's this alternation in beach dynamics. So this is a rather complicated figure here, and I'm going to walk you through it. We have here the West Pacific region with the island of New Guinea. And in red, we have sea surface currents that are waters that are advected from the South Pacific, whereas the blue arrows are sea surface currents that are advected from the North Pacific. So what I want you to remember is this feature over here, and this is called the New Guinea Coastal Current. This current is actually measured in situ with shipboard instruments and mooring buoys. And the interesting aspect about this current is that it reverses seasonally with these winds. So here we have a snapshot of what happens during the southeast trade wind season. And you see that the New Guinea coastal current follows the direction of the winds. It gets into an eddy here. And this is the New Guinea eddy. And it advects towards the east. And part of it goes into the Halmahera eddy and deflects into the North Equatorial Countercurrent, which brings waters all the way to the East Pacific. And the NGCC, the New Guinea Coastal Current, flows at considerable speeds of 60 to 80 centimeters, 0.6 to 0.8 meters per second. What happens during the opposing season when the winds blow like this? The New Guinea Coastal Current reverses completely. But the speeds are not as fast. So the velocity of the current is about 0.2 to 0.3 meters per second. So this is, for me, one important consideration in all the work that I do, is the presence of this current. When looking at other types of data, this is surface velocity data measured by drifters. When we look at these maps, with the red colors are warm waters and blue are cold waters, and the black arrows are the direction in which the currents are flowing, we see that during the months of July to September, during the period 1982 to 2008, we see clearly the New Guinea coastal current flowing all along the island of New Guinea, including along north of the Bird's Head. When we look at what's happening during the northwest monsoon season, January to March, we see that this area is not resolved. There are no surface drifters available for that period. Additionally, when one looks at satellite data, the problem with the sensors that the satellites bring on board is that they don't resolve the parameters on the near shore scale, the parameters that enable us to derive sea surface currents. This is a complicated issue that is related to differential heating and cooling of land versus sea. Now that you've seen the effects of the wind regimes on the oceanography and the feedback between the physical and the biological factors. Let's have a look at the implication these factors, these phenomenon have on the post-nesting migration routes. So remember, these turtles, they come and they come to the beach. They have this whole period of approximately 2 and 2.5 months during which they reproduce and they nest, they breed, they mate, and they nest, and they don't eat, they don't feed during that period. And at the very end of that period, they migrate back, and this is called the post-nesting migration. And this is an important thing because we want to know where these turtles forage. So this figure is not yet published. This is from Scott Benson from NOAA, someone I work with, and I think it's an amazing image because it combines all the tracks of all the turtles that he's tagged during the past decade, from 2000 to last year. And you see in blue, these are all the post-nesting tracks of turtles that were tagged off Jarmo's Mamedi. That's the beach of the trades season. And you see that all these turtles remain in the northern hemisphere. And these are the guys that forage off California and Oregon. Some of them go to the South China Sea. Some of them go really in the North Pacific. And the tracks in red are the turtles that were tagged in the other reach, which is only 30 kilometers away, but during the opposing season, when the northwest monsoon blows. And you see here that these turtles predominantly migrate towards the South Pacific. So when looking at these patterns of migration, an obvious question comes to mind. So do these tracks reflect what happened to the turtles at the very early life stages? Especially when one keeps in mind the trajectory of the New Guinea coastal current, we tended to think that these turtles, when they're really small, when they were born during the northwest monsoon, they got carried away by the New Guinea coastal current that flowed in this direction. And because hatchlings imprint on their nesting beaches, and we know that because the adults always return to the places where they're born, why wouldn't they imprint also on their foraging areas? So, and this is pretty much in line with the current thought, the current paradigm of in this particular field, that hatchlings, sea turtles, are also able to imprint at a very early stage of their lives on the initial sites where they get dispersed. So coming back to the life cycle of sea turtles, we're going to look at the other half. So the females lay their nests in the sand. These 100 eggs hatch after approximately an incubation time of approximately 60 days. And the little turtles crawl out of the sand, rush down the beach, and this is where most of the predation happens. They tend to time their hatching at night because there's less predators. And yet, there is just an amazing number of these animals that get snatched by crabs and by monitor lizards and by pigs and by dogs, etc., etc. So there is a very few, and nobody knows exactly how many of them eventually reach adulthood, but it's a very small percentage. And basically, what happens afterwards is pretty much unknown. What is known is that they are in a state of swimming frenzy, and they bring along this reserve of energy, this yolk sac that enables them to swim for a number of days. In the case of leatherbacks, it's estimated that they have a swimming frenzy of about 30 days. And so they swim to get as fast as possible away from the coast where most predators are, and they get entrained in sea surface currents. And from what we know of other species, they tend to aggregate in convergence lines, and these are areas where currents converge. And these convergence lines tend to concentrate flotsam and debris. And this is what you can see when you go out fishing with a boat and you see these lines of debris. These are convergences. And these also concentrate food for turtles. So we know from turtles in the Gulf of Mexico that they concentrate in these areas. But we don't know what happens with leatherbacks. Oops. So the next thing we know is that turtles are sighted again when they are considerably bigger. One likes to say as big as a dinner plate. In the case of leatherbacks, the smallest reported sightings of leatherbacks are about 60 centimeters. So basically, we don't know what happens between they're this size and this size. This is colloquially called the lost years, and we don't know if it's one lost year or two lost years or three lost years. We call it the lost years. So basically, this is a video that I took in West Papua last year, and you see the very large body-to-flipper ratio of these turtles. It shows you that these leatherbacks are extremely strong swimmers. Of all the hatchlings of sea turtles, those are the strong swimmers. So this is basically where the story starts, the lost year starts, this image. So what do we know about the lost years? We know that in the case of loggerheads that you see here and green turtles have been studied in the Gulf of Mexico, and also in the West Atlantic, we know that they concentrate in downwelling areas, but in the case of leatherbacks, we don't know anything. We know that in lab experiments, leatherbacks, which are the fastest swimmers, swim from 8 to 30 centimeters per second, or 5 to 30 kilometers per day in motionless water. We know also that currently the passive drifter, the idea that turtles are passive drifters, is being challenged because it's been shown that turtles are able to use magnetic cues in order to actively navigate and retain a certain course in order to remain within favorable currents. And in the case of complex areas such as Papua, that has a very complex geography, very complex sea bottom topography, very strong local currents, tidal currents, there is possibly very strong local effects on dispersal. So we cannot forget to look at the very near shore scale if you want to understand how these turtles get dispersed in the ocean. There's two things to remember. They're very strong swimmers, so they're partially able to navigate and to determine their own fate. And the other thing is that we cannot forget the near shore scale. So what is the importance of the lost years? In the case of actually almost any animal species, the survival of juveniles is critical to the maintenance of populations. Yet, despite this importance, we know very little or almost nothing about the first years of leatherbacks. So my question here is, could changing oceanographic conditions, changes in these reversals and in the timing of these reversals of, for instance, the New Guinea coastal current, have an effect on the survival, on the probability of survival of these hatchlings, meaning that turtles that are born in a certain period of year get dispersed by this current and carried away, carried into less favorable areas than they used to, because conditions are changing. And potential changes explain? Could they explain the reason why one of the beaches has seen a drop in nesting, and one of the beaches has seen an increase, a stable level of nesting, or an increase? So obviously, we're talking on the long term here. So for my work, I want to focus on the first 30 days, which corresponds to the swimming frenzy period, and also corresponds to the period that they're close to shore. So traditionally, recently, because we have more powerful computers, we're able to model, we're able to build predictive models of how turtles might disperse. So here you see in these noodle effects here, these are current models that use satellite data, and researchers release these virtual drifting turtles in these models and give them a time frame. So for instance, here they release 5,000 turtles off the coast of Yucatan, and they give them 2 months' time to drift with the current, and they look where they end up. And you see that they very neatly join the Gulf Stream here. A lot of them remain in the Gulf of Mexico. Here in the case of turtles that are released off Cuba and Puerto Rico, some of them remain within the Caribbean Sea, and some remain in the West Atlantic. They don't get entrained as much in the Gulf Stream, et cetera, et cetera. So you can make all of this is a very nice exercise, gives you a general idea of what would happen if a turtle were released far from shore, if it wouldn't move. And obviously these are the shortcomings also of these models, that they assume that turtles are passive drifters, they don't navigate. And they also these models only work from a distance of at least 60 nautical miles from shore, because of this problem that I told you about the satellite sensors. So of course, nothing beats the real data. But it's a real challenge because those animals are so small. The ideal device is a satellite tag. This is a colleague of mine, Jane Mansfield from University of Florida. I think she works in NOAA now. And she tagged the smallest turtle to date. This is a 300-gram turtle. It's about seven times the weight of a hatchling. And it's got the smallest satellite transmitter that's been manufactured to date. It's a solar-powered transmitter. And this turtle was released off Florida, and it followed very neatly the Gulf Stream along the continental shelf of the U.S. East Coast. So, of course, it's a very impressive data. But it's not applicable to my turtles because I really look at the newborns. So we're limited, up to now, we're limited to direct tracking. So we're limited to putting very, very small devices on the turtles, remain fairly close, and try to follow their movements. Until now, researchers have used VHF radio transmitters. The problem with radio transmitters is what happens when the turtle dives, or what happens when there's a big wave that comes. Waves, water shelters or cancels out radio signals. So it's very easy to lose an animal like this. And this is why I haven't found any maps of hatchling dispersal. So people have been able to follow at best a couple of hours these turtles, and then they've abandoned the turtle, disappeared, because of the limitations of radio tagging. So yes, last year I invented a method. I thought, okay, so obviously I'm not going to work with these radio tags. I'm going to try something else. And so I found these little tags, so maybe you can see them. They weigh 4.5 grams, and these are acoustic tags, little pingers. And I said, I'm going to attach one of those pingers to a turtle and see what happens. So I came up with little bobbers, fishing bobbers. I painted them orange so I can see them easily. And then I hung this tag from the fishing bobber with a very thin fishing line. And then I tethered the other part to the sea turtle, attached with a little fishing hook to the last cute on the carapace. It doesn't hurt. And I thought, okay, this is probably going to work. And so I went to Papua to carry out a pilot study to compare these methods. So I want to compare the performance of these VHF, these radio tags that you see here, versus these acoustic tags. They're a little bit different to the ones that I showed you. And so I did the same thing. I mounted a VHF tag through a bobber, so the antenna goes through the bobber like this, and the turtle drags it behind it. And here you see me listening with a hydrophone under the water to the listening for these acoustic signals, acoustic pings. So what I did first, before I did these live trials, I put a mooring buoy out, and I put tags on top of the mooring buoy, so the VHF tags outside, sticking out of the water. And then underneath the mooring buoy, at two different depths, I had two different types of tag. One control tag, very powerful one to see if power had an effect on the performance, and one of my small miniature pingers. And the two parameters that I wanted to assess was directionality, which is your capability of detecting the exact source, the direction of the signal. And the other parameter that I measured was transmission range, basically how far away can I hear a signal. And the results are that the directionality of acoustic tags, of my little pingers, are vastly superior to radio tags. And if you can look here, this is an inverted graph. You see here on the x-axis, you see the distance from source, from zero here to 1,500 meters. And here is the arc length of the signal reception in degrees, with 0 degrees here and 80 degrees over here. And you see that basically what I did is I measured, so if, for instance, the signal is emitted from the fish tank there, and I with my hydrophone moving like this, I would look at the total angle, the total area in which I would receive a signal. So the wider the area, the less accurate my method is, because that means that the area is like this, it means that the sound could come from there, from there, from there, or from there. So you see here that both acoustic tags, within 10 degrees angle, I was able to receive this signal. So I could narrow the angle to 10 degrees. And with the angle of VHF tags of almost 80 degrees, especially in the larger distances from the source, it's very difficult to find the location of the signal. So when you're tracking an animal that's about this big in the open ocean, you lose it very quickly. So what I did is I attached two radio tags to turtles, and I followed them, and sure enough, after an hour or so, I lost them. So I lost $300 in an hour. And I think, okay, this is it. I'm done with the radio tags. So basically, the transmission ranges are the same for both tags. But I realized that directionality is the single most important parameter when you want to track small animals, not only sea turtles, but if you want to track sharks, etc. Directionality is the most important factor. So after that, I think, okay, I'm here in Jamos Bay. I just might as well just start tracking and see how the hatchlings disperse of Jamos Bameri, and which factors influence behavior. So I had to define behavior. And behavior for me is defined by two parameters, which are displacement speed and swimming direction. Because I was not able to measure currents together with the turtles, I wasn't able to measure swimming speed. Because the movement of a turtle is determined by both the drift by the current, the force of the current, plus the swimming of the turtle. Because I was not able to measure the effect of the current, I couldn't say that what I saw was the swimming speed, but it was more like the displacement speed. So that's one component of behavior, and the other component was the swimming direction. The swimming direction I knew because I put two bobbers with the setup, and so I could see from a distance, from 30, 40 meters away, 120 feet away, I could see when the bobbers were here and here, I knew that the swimming direction was like this. I just had to draw a line between the two bobbers. So I was just following these turtles, my boat. What I did is I tracked turtles that were tethered first, and after 6 or 7 hours, that's more or less what the local boatman wants to work, I would go to the capture my little turtle, and I would untether the tracking unit, and I would release it untethered, and I would try to track it as long as possible visually. And I did that because I wanted to know if the drag of this tracking unit had an effect on the behavior of the turtles. And I can't do that if I don't measure its normal behavior, its free swimming behavior. Finally, what I also did is I looked at three levels of fitness. I looked at turtles that freshly hatched, that I released right away the same morning. Some turtles I kept in a container, and because they're in a swimming frenzy, they continue moving and they continue depleting their energy. So turtles that are older than 24 hours are less fit than the ones that are fresh. And finally, I also tracked stragglers, and these are turtles that were not able to crawl out of their own nests for obvious reasons, probably because they were less strong than the other turtles. So here you have the first ever map of sea turtle hatchling dispersal. And so you can see here, the green lines are the tracks of the turtles, and the white arrows are the swimming directions of the turtles. And you see something very interesting here also here, right off the bat, is that these swimming directions don't follow the trajectories, dispersal trajectories. And this is a strong indication that there is already, on this very near shore scale, there's a strong westward flowing current. Now here are a series of tracks over here that are not deflected. Obviously these turtles were not tracked all on the same day. This is over. So there is here, on a very short time scale, there are variations in these near shore currents. So to resume the results, these are tracks of 15 turtles, totaling 60 hours of tracking. The maximum track length was 7 kilometers, 7 hours of tracking. The mean displacement speed of these turtles was 24 meters per second, which is more or less the reported swimming speed of leatherbacks. And I put between parentheses the velocity of the New Guinea coastal current during this season, which is about 0.6 to 0.8 meters per second. I noted not one of my hatchlings was predated. So this is something that I kind of believe that most of the predation, at least in this spot, with troubled water, turbid water, most of the predation occurs on land. During daytime, it would be by seabirds. And once in the water, I think they're relatively safe. And of course, this near shore current, I think, is an important feature. So what I did, with my analysis of trying to find out which factors best explain these data, I used generalized additive modeling, GAM, to look at which factors best explain displacement speed. And I was able to rank these factors, and I found that current, presence or absence of current, best explains the data, followed by the level of fitness, with fresh turtles having a faster displacement speed than the unfit turtles, those that are more than 24 hours old. And I also found that the hours after full and new moon, I wasn't able to measure tides. I didn't have a tide gauge, but I used hours after full and new moon in my analysis, which is a proxy to tidal flow. And this is also one of the factors that explains the data. And finally, the last two factors are tethered, whether the turtle was tethered or not, which is a proxy, which indicates an effect of drag on the displacement speed. And, drag is not as important as these other three factors over here. And swimming direction was the last factor of importance. Now, looking at swimming direction, we see that turtles consistently swam north to northeast, and none of the aforementioned factors explained the swimming direction. And this is not a surprise, as we know that hatchlings are primarily follow magnetic cues in their initial dispersal. And for instance, I would release some of the little hatchlings that I got overnight. I would release them next to my tent under the trees, and this is a flat area. You cannot see the beach. There's no inclination, there's no slope that could hint where the beach is. I would put them in a flat area in the shade, and I would turn them the head towards the mountain, and they would immediately, like the hands of a compass, they would switch towards the beach. It gives you an idea how hardwired they are to swim to a particular direction. So what does this show? It shows, first of all, that acoustic tracking is, at this stage, the best method to do the field work. It's a strong indication that nearshore dispersal is mediated by tidal currents. There's also the fact that fitness is an important factor. And it also suggests that swimming frenzy is critical for turtles to reach these conveyor belts, such as the New Guinea coastal current. And these conveyor belts, in turn, are important because they'll be bringing these turtles to areas that are rich in food, because at a certain stage, they'll start feeding. After the swimming frenzy is over, they'll start feeding. And by then, hopefully, they'll have reached these productive areas. Also, we've seen in the dispersal map that some of the tracks went straight up, along more or less along with the swimming direction, and some of the tracks went deflected strongly towards the west. So we see that even on a weekly time scale, almost on a daily time scale, there's a strong variation in these currents. So this brings the question that these turtles, how do these variations on these very short time scales, how do they impact turtles in terms of their ability to reach these larger scale currents? So in my future work, I'll be trying to connect these different scales. I've been looking really at a small nearshore scale. And what I try to do is I'll deploy surface drifters so I can measure the currents concurrently with the turtles. And that way, when I'm able to release a surface drifter at the same time that I start tracking a turtle, I'll be able to tease out what behavior does in terms of deflection with respect to an ideal passive drift. And that way, when I stop tracking after 8 or 9 hours, I'll try to push the limits, maybe to 12 hours or whatever, I'll still have the surface drifters that are going to indicate what the current does, and I'll know from my tracking what the behavior component is, what deflection is caused by behavior. And that way, I'll be able to predict, hopefully, what happens beyond the scales, that I can directly look at the turtles. I'll be also looking at seasonal and interannual variations. So that means that I'll go to the other beach, to the winter beach, the monsoon beach, and carry out the same work and see if there's differences and see how fast, for instance, these surface drifters will connect with the New Guinea coastal current that will flow towards the south. And I'll also look at the satellite data, the large-scale data that can show me what the effect is of El Nino, for instance, because it's known that El Nino also influences the strength of the New Guinea coastal current. And finally, I'm thinking of developing an instrument together with a friend here. I'm thinking of developing an instrument that will enable me to track a whole cloud of hatchling. And that way, I'll have a more representative sample size. And hopefully, it will hopefully track at night also. This is actually what I'm going to do this summer. So I'm going to mount little LEDs also in the bobbers, because even with an acoustic tag on it, if I really want to get a good position, I need to get very close. And when I get really close, it is more difficult to get exactly the position of the tracking unit. So if I have a little light in my bower, I'll be able to, for the last 20 meters, be able to pinpoint the position and record the GPS coordinates of that turtle. So that's basically my research work. Now, I have another facet. There's another facet to my career here. I have, during the years that I was working in Papua, I have developed very strong partnerships with the local university, which is called UNIPA, University of Papua. And I've decided to create, together with Liz Johnstone, who is here, is sitting over there, I've decided to develop a program, a collaborative program between Scripps and the university in Papua, which is called SURGA, which is the Scripps-UNIPA Regional Geographical Alliance. And SURGA in Indonesian means heaven, which is basically what this area is here. This is Raja Ampat. And some of you here have been in Raja Ampat recently, so you know what I'm talking about. And basically, this program, SURGA, consists in establishing scientific collaborations between Scripps scientists willing to work in this scientifically virgin, almost virgin area of the world, and Indonesian colleagues. We have already a memorandum of understanding set up, the logistics already, and we hope that we can foster an enduring collaborations that will encourage academic collaborations, partnerships, and also help build the academic capacity of the Papuans, because they are ultimately the shepherds of their environments. So I cannot dissociate my work as a scientist from my mission as a conservationist, especially when you work with animals that are so endangered and areas that are so beautiful. One has to think of protecting this part. And it's just not viable saying, okay, I'm going to work 4 years there, I'm going to do my best for conservation, because it will only work for 4 years. But if we can build the scientists of tomorrow, we'll make a great step forward. And so basically, these are pictures of what you've seen right now. That we are, Liz and myself, were the two first participants with our PIs in this initiative. Greg Rouse, who is also in marine biology at Scripps, will also join at the end of this year. And we hope that we'll do lots of great things. And that's it for now. Thank you. So the question is if in the next stage of my research I'm going to take hatchlings further out to sea to track them. Actually, I'm not. I really want to replicate nature, so I'm going to release hatchlings really close to shore. I'm going to bring them beyond the waves, because the problem is if you release them in the wave area, because they're dragging these bobbers, the waves will push them back on the beach. So I'm just bringing beyond the waves, and then I'll release them. But at the same time, I'll release surface drifters. And what I'll do is I'll leave the surface drifter drift away for weeks at a time until they stop transmitting, and the surface drifters are going to replicate the passive drift of the hatchling. Whereas my work, the active tracking, will enable me to know how much the turtle deviates from this passive drift. Yeah, that's a good question. If I have unfortunate interactions with locals, I have lots of stories to tell about that. In this specific area, we have sometimes tense relationships with locals, and it's mainly due because of the actually, it hasn't to do anything with what I do, but there's people in Papua can be a little bit hot-headed. They can get angry very quickly, and there are lots of misconceptions. They, for instance, thought that when we started putting tags in turtles in order to identify them, that these tags were causing the turtles to go away. And they thought that the conservationists, the scientists, had big magnets in America that would attract the turtles, because the turtles had these metal tags on them, that the turtles would go to these magnets, and that explained why the turtles were disappearing. And so we're still having a hard time trying to talk to the locals and try to explain it has nothing to do with it. And so we realize that this has a lot to do with the fact that conservationists and scientists are pretty self-absorbed and only focused on their science and don't really care about the people. And I think that's a major mistake, especially because the locals are really the shepherds of their environment, and if you don't get the locals on board, you won't be able to protect these resources. So that's why we try to change things now, and we try to really focus on try to bring welfare to these communities. I got a lot of donations from Scripps partners now to give to the locals. So the question is, if I can see leatherbacks?
Yeah, how deep are they into the current?
They're
passive.
So you're talking about the hatchlings, or you're talking about the adults?
No, close to 1 ton.
Oh yeah, the large animals. They can go very deep. I think that the deepest dives recorded are over a kilometer deep.
And they're moving there.
Oh yeah, sure. Oh, they're very. So the adults are very strong swimmers.
Yeah. So it's continuous.
Continuous. They're not very passive. But still, if you put these tracks of these individuals of the adults and you overlay these tracks with the large scale currents, you see that they're smart. Also, they want to minimize their energy expenditure and they kind of follow the currents too.
Yeah.
But they're very active, very strong swimmers. There's no way you can keep up with them swimming. But in general, when you see them, it's when they're at the surface and when you almost hit them with a boat and yeah. So the question is whether the tracking unit has an adverse effect on the turtles. I always release, at the end of each tracking run, I catch the turtle again, and I release them. Because I don't want to cause the death of such a critically endangered animal. So, yeah. And with the statistical, at least my statistical analysis of my fairly small sample size until now, shows that the tracking unit is not the most important factor that explains the data. The currents are more important, the fitness are more important. So the question is, if the very large leatherbacks are seen in the Pacific Northwest, where they originate from? It's from the data we have, they're from the West, they're from New Guinea. They're from West Papua. So that's as much as we know. And really, ideally, we'd have to capture them at sea and put a tag on them. Hope it's not hope it's a female that's about to leave, because sometimes you put a tag on a female at sea, and it has just returned from nesting, and it'll just hang around for 2 years. And by then, the battery of your satellite tag is done. So it's really it's tricky. Yeah, sure. So the question is whether a turtle that nests on one beach, if it comes back after in its next reproductive cycle, if it comes back to the beach and the beach has changed, has been eroded away, whether that turtle would try to nest somewhere else. And they sure do. So this picture that I showed you of the turtles nesting one season, peaking one season in one place and peaking the other, that's a very idealized picture. It's just for the sake of simplicity, but in fact there are a number of individuals that also jump over from one beach to the other, and there is sometimes turtles that are tagged, are satellite tagged, females are satellite tagged. They start their post-nesting migration, they start leaving the beach where they've nested 5-6 times, and then suddenly they diverge and they go to the Solomon Islands and they nest one more time. It's probably because they had one additional clutch of eggs. They say, oh, I need to go, and then they'll just... And that's the way turtles on very long timescales, geological timescales, ensure that they keep all these area colonized. Otherwise, the sea turtles would be wiped out with all these changes if they'd be so faithful to one spot. They need to have some... how do you say that? So there is approximately 2 weeks. So the question is that how many clutches of eggs leatherbacks lay, and over what period of time. And this really, this varies from place to place. Varies. The Atlantic leatherbacks have a different different behavior. In the case of the leatherbacks in Papua, it can be 5 to 7 times, and approximately 2 weeks between each nesting event. So about 10 to 14 weeks. That's the duration of the nesting season. The question is whether a significant harvest of the eggs on the beaches. And there used to be, up to maybe 15 years ago, until the locals were involved in these in the community patrol. So since the locals started working as patrolmen for the World Wildlife Fund and also for the University of Papua, they have stopped consuming the eggs. Yep.
Jeff, I want to thank you very much for a fascinating.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.